Hello and welcome back to Learn It From a Layman. I am Carl Christensen. I am joined tonight by a first-time guest, Seth Vogel. Seth, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Carl.
For those that have been following our podcast for a while, Seth, they've heard the name Vogel a few times. So I was thinking about this before the podcast. When you get together with your family, Seth, it's got to be that scene from Spies movie, whatever. Doctor.
Oh, Doctor. Yeah. Isn't that from MASH or something?
Yeah, something like that. I don't remember. But early, mid-80s, that's got to be like your family, you know, when you guys get together, right?
Essentially. I think there's two of us that are not in doctors. Medicine. And I think only one of us doesn't have some sort of a graduate Doctor. Degree.
Yeah, exactly. So Seth here has a I believe you have an MD PhD, correct?
Yes.
So you are yourself Dr. Doctor.
I'm Dr. Doctor and a glutton for punishment.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like with that much education, you should be able to charge people for not calling you by both of your titles. but yeah, your doctorate in neuroscience. Go ahead and tell me what your doctorate, not neuroscience?
Neuroscience, yep.
Okay, that's what I was pretty sure. And then you currently are finishing, you're doing residency in anesthesiology. And where did you get your medical degree from?
I got my medical degree at Tufts University in Boston. And I'm a resident at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon right now.
Awesome. Okay. And Seth joined us tonight on the podcast to talk about the basics of putting people to sleep. That's
something that I've had a lot of practice with lately with my small children as well as at the job.
Yeah, exactly. All kinds of practice. So anesthesia is something I think that everyone has experienced and or will experience in their life, but has, you know, just the layman's exposure to it as far as it's done to them. So we're going to give them a little bit of insight into what it does and how it works. And Seth has got a wealth of knowledge to share with us. So, okay, Seth, what happens in the brain when you put someone under?
So one of the reasons why I got into anesthesia in the first place was I was looking for a medical field that had some big questions that were unanswered because I want to continue to do research in whatever medical specialty I ended up in. And anesthesia kind of struck me because there's so many things that we don't know about it. What happens in the brain is sort of a mystery. There's certain things that we can say, like, you know, brain waves tend to slow down in certain aspects. It approximates what your brain would activity would look like when you're sleeping with like natural sleep. But in other ways, it looks different. And we really don't know how most of our anesthetics work on like a mechanistic level, other than like they do something to the neurons. And some other things that happen that are like helpful for surgery and the reasons why anesthesia is so effective is it gets rid of your sensation of pain. It gets rid of your formation of new memories, which is helpful. No one wants to wake up, remember everything that happened during the surgery.
Yeah.
And it also blunts a lot of your reflexes. So when we're putting an artificial airway in someone's trachea or something, you don't want them to gag and choke or cough or something. And so inducing anesthesia takes away those reflexes so that they're not going to, they're not going to move when you put a tube in, and they're also not going to move when they get when the surgeons go and make their big incision.
Yeah, which you were telling me a little bit about before the podcast. You're doing incisions right now too. So, quick question that you said you understand, like, some of the brain waves are different and some of the same as far as sleep. I had general anesthesia relatively recently. Actually, I had a minor procedure, and they put me under. And for me, it feels just like sleep. But is it the case that that given how the brain's working, you said you can't form memories. Are people dreaming? Is the brain not having that ability to do that type of function either?
In some ways, it's sort of an unanswerable question, because even like in a normal night, if you ask people like whether they dreamt last night, most people would say yes some of the time and no some of the time, depending on, you know, it's a very normal experience to sometimes not remember any dreams and sometimes to remember them. However, if you look at like what's known about sleep, we go through different stages of sleep. There's non-REM sleep that has several different stages depending on how deep it is. And during those stages, your brain activity looks different than during REM sleep, which stands for rapid eye movement sleep. And it turns out that people, almost everybody, goes through REM sleep 4 or 5 times during a normal night's rest. And during REM, you are always dreaming. The reason why you don't remember 4 or 5 different dreams every night is because you're only going to remember that dream if you wake up during it. So if you wake up during REM sleep, you're going to remember what was going through your head at that point. If you wake up during non-REM sleep, then you're not going to remember your dreams, but you had them. And so, with anesthesia, you know, you would have to wake someone up during the brainwaves that are induced by anesthesia look more similar to non-REM sleep anyway. So okay. I would say it's unlikely that people are dreaming, but if they were, you know, you'd have to wake them up pretty quickly and fast enough that they could, like, you know, tell you what they were thinking. And usually people don't wake up that lucid. They go right through twilight period where they're not going to be able to communicate complex things like what they were thinking about while they were under.
Yeah, I was going to ask you another. So we're kind of jumping around in the list that we had determined on here. But the one of the experiences I heard of a number of years ago was that a young man that I knew had gone under, I don't remember what surgery he had had, but he had general anesthesia, and he had been, at the time, he was learning a second language. Mm-hmm. And he'd only been learning a second language for, I don't know, a month. Let's just say he was not fluent by any sure. means. But when he came out of general anesthesia, he, for a brief period of time, he only could communicate in the second language. Yeah, and
I've never experienced that with my patients before, but I would I'd be fascinated to meet someone who went to sleep speaking one language and woke up speaking a different one.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. Given how at the time I was teaching him the second language, and I knew how bad he how poorly he spoke that language. I was like, he spoke hopefully that.
Listener of the podcast.
Anyway. Yeah, that's so fascinating. And you said, are you currently, is there research currently obviously underway then to try to better understand what's happening in the brain during a general anesthesia or anesthesia in general?
Yeah, for sure. Lots of people are looking into that and trying to figure it out. It's been a notoriously tricky problem to solve. There's been some advancements, but I would say like it's been small. There hasn't been major breakthroughs in understanding it. The reason people want to know how it works is if you could figure out on like a cellular or like circuit level, like how anesthesia accomplishes all of these beneficial things for surgery, you may be able to find different safer drugs that work on the same systems.
Okay.
Drugs that we have were kind of discovered serendipitously, and it's like, oh, here's this thing that that does this other thing, and we can use that, but we have no idea how it's accomplishing it.
This sounds kind of like how penicillin came about then. Okay. Well, that takes us to our next question then. And Matt just joined us as well. So Matt, at any time, if you have questions about anesthesia, we're diving into that. But Seth, you said the drugs that we have, what drugs do we have? How many different, you know, is there a whole slew of drugs that we have? Are you picking from two? What are the drugs and how do they work?
Yeah, so we've got a whole arsenal of medications to accomplish different things, but in general, they fall into a few like categories. We have anesthetic agents, and I'm using that in like a very technical sense, where I mean agents that are used to render you unconscious. And so those are broken down into like volatile gases, the first of which was ether, discovered in the 1800s and kind of jump started anesthesia as a medical field. But since then we've moved on from ether, which was highly flammable, and you can imagine that would be problematic in the operating room where they're sometimes using cautery and stuff, to more modern inhaled gases like sevoflurane, isoflurane. So those are probably the most commonly used ones. And then there are other general category of anesthetic agents is IV anesthetics. And the most commonly used one there is called propofol. So you can inject propofol into a vein and continuously and keep someone asleep that way. Mm-hmm. And then another bucket of like medications in the anesthesiologist toolbox, we have paralytics to make sure that people don't move while they're operating. Sometimes surgeons are doing something very delicate and they don't want a patient to cough or even have like any sort of movement. So we paralyze them for the surgery and then we can unparalyze them at the end. And then there's a bunch of drugs that are used for hemodynamic goals to keep your blood pressure high or bring it down if your blood pressure is too high. So we're trying to keep everything within like a nice physiological range. And so we have things that will bring that up, bring that down, bring heart rate down. And then, you know, we are also the ones giving antibiotics, and those are kind of the big ones, but yeah.
Okay. Anecdotal question then. Like I said, recently had general anesthesia. I've had general anesthesia twice. Both times, the anesthesiologist has told me, and I always wonder if they're lying, but they've said that, like, when they put, both times I've had, you know, something put over my face. And within 10 seconds after that, I'm out. But they've told me when they're putting it on, this won't put you to sleep. It's the IV that's going to put you to sleep. Is that true?
That is almost surely true in your case.
Okay.
So before we put someone off to sleep, we give them a mask to breathe 100% oxygen. And the reason for that is room air that you're breathing, that you and I are breathing right now, is 70% nitrogen and only 21% oxygen. So your lungs have 5 or 6 liters of volume in them, but only 20% of that or so is oxygen. So if you stop breathing right now, that 1 liter of oxygen is your oxygen reserve that you can basically take from while you're breath holding. If we give you 100% oxygen to breathe for a few minutes before going off to sleep, we're getting rid of all that nitrogen in your lungs and replacing it with oxygen. So instead of having a 1 liter reserve of oxygen, you may have 4 or 5. And that means that if we have trouble getting that breathing tube in, it's not going to be a situation where we're where we only have 2 minutes before you start having oxygen desaturation. So if your lungs are filled with 100% oxygen, you can go 7-8 minutes before anything bad happens. And then, okay. so that's what the mask is for. And then the IV medication is what got you off to sleep.
Okay. So they weren't lying to me, is what you're saying.
They weren't lying to you. That being okay. said, you can put someone to sleep by breathing gas through the mask. It's just a little bit less pleasant. And so we don't normally do that to people.
Okay.
Okay. Cause people kind of cough and choke and gag, and they don't like the smell and all that.
All right. Well, that didn't happen to me. So I'll assume they weren't lying to me then, and that they were being straight with me. That's good to know. They seemed like good doctors. So
that's good.
yeah. Good medical care here. Nothing to complain about. Okay. You mentioned the variety of different drugs that you have and kind of the buckets that go in and that different, you know, types of drugs, different types of medication serve different purposes. Is it just the goal of the surgery or the you know, the procedure that's being done that determines the type of anesthesia that you use? Or is it, are there particular characteristics of, I mean, are people allergic to particular anesthesia, or what are the different characteristics that you use to determine which drug?
Yeah, so a lot of it does depend on the surgery. If you're having like a minor dermatologic procedure where they're taking out a cyst or something from your arm, we probably don't want to completely knock you out for that and induce general anesthesia, because there's some risks that go along with it. And there's no reason to assume those risks if you can do something that's less risky and still accomplish the surgery. So we try and do the least invasive thing that we can to accomplish the goal. And that largely depends on the surgery that's happening. But then, as you mentioned, we also take into account patient-specific factors. So maybe for the exact same surgery, we're going to do something different for patient A versus patient B, because patient B maybe had a bad reaction to opioids or something and got super nauseous and constipated for days or whatever. And so we may choose a different type of pain management for that patient. If someone is allergic to our normal surgical antibiotic, of course, we're not going to give them that, because that would cause all sorts of problems. And then patients, like other medical conditions, can also affect what we give them. So if someone has really poorly controlled hypertension, I'm going to draw up some different medications before we even start the surgery, because I know that we're going to be battling high blood pressure the whole time. And for other patients, you know, we may be thinking that we're going to need to be boosting the blood pressure. So I might have more of those drugs ready to go.
Okay. It's kind of an anecdotal question as well, but like, I obviously haven't gone under anesthesia. The layman goes, sees their anesthesiologist. That's like the last person they see, and then they're out. And then you don't see them again after surgery. How long are you, as an anesthesiologist, involved in the OR? Do you just put them to sleep and wash your hands? I'm done here. Or what does that look like?
Sometimes that would be nice, because there are cases where it can get a little bit dull during this. If it's a long surgery and the patient is super stable, I may not be doing a whole lot back there, other than closely watching the monitors and making sure that it stays smooth sailing. Yeah. But you do have your anesthesiologist in there the entire time. You're not okay. allowed to leave the room, except for breaks, which is a very important part of the profession. So we give each other breaks during the day. And part of that is a patient safety thing. Not just, you know, job satisfaction, but right. You want someone, if there's a 13-hour surgery and someone is sitting there staring at the monitors for 13 hours, they may zone out and not pick up on something. So you want them to be rested enough and that they can maintain that vigilance and like alertness in case something bad happens. So we get a like morning break and a lunch break and an afternoon break. And I think the surgery colleagues are always jealous because they're sitting there like on their feet, sweating, like
right.
bending the patient. And I'm like going off for my 30-minute lunch break. I never get a lunch break.
Is this why you chose anesthesiology, Seth?
Partly, yes.
Yeah, we've had this discussion with a friend of mine that's on the podcast frequently. He's a doctor. He's a pediatrician. And we've had this discussion that in the medical field, it's often the case that the doctor's health is not considered enough. You know, the doctor has to put up with needs to be a consideration in like their quality of care. And that's certainly not taken into consideration during residency. You're treated like a, you know, you're
the expendable. Bottom.
Yeah, exactly. Bottom of the totem pole.
Yeah. And there's definitely some cultural differences across different specialties too. So, I actually really enjoyed my surgery rotations during medical school. I liked operating, but the culture of surgery residency sort of scared me off from that because they're notorious for working their residents especially hard. And so, you know, you're working 80 hours a week consistently compared to the anesthesia residents where the culture is just not as workaholic, I guess.
Okay.
So anesthesiologists appreciate good work-life balance, and they even pass that on to the residents to a certain extent. You know, I think we still work more hours than the supervising doctors, but not by a crazy amount.
Yeah. Our mutual cousin Ian Christensen was on a number of months ago, and he's an ophthalmologist. And I feel like, yeah, you guys have picked doctor fields that are kind to the doctors as well. So, okay, a couple questions then about general anesthesia, and to some degree, it feels like the layman might be better served by not knowing the. But you know, we believe in you know telling people the truth. Yeah, exactly. Let's be transparent here. What's the difference between, before we get to the interesting, more, tell me a little bit about local anesthetic anesthesia versus a general anesthesia. What's the difference?
Yeah, so I was referencing earlier, like doing the least invasive type of anesthesia possible for this to accomplish the surgery. And for something like a dermatologic surgery, you know, if you're getting like a little cyst or a mole removed, you may not even require an anesthesiologist because you may just get a little injection of some numbing medication, like some lidocaine around the site. And that would be an example of local anesthesia. There are more involved types of local anesthesia. So if you cut off your thumb and we need to like reattach it or something, they can do what's called a beer block, where they basically put like some tourniquets on the arm and then fill the veins like after the tourniquets with lidocaine so that the entire arm gets numb.
Okay, sounds fun.
That's something that an anesthesiologist would do. But that is also a local anesthesia technique. So local is just, you know, acting at the site that is being operated on. And it works by knocking out the transmission of electrical signals to the nerves that are bathed in the local anesthetic agent, like lidocaine. It's the same sort of medication you get at the dentist.
Mm-hmm.
General anesthesia is body-wide, but most important organ for general anesthesia is the brain, because that's where we're really hoping to have the biggest effect, knocking out consciousness and pain perception and reflexes and all of that. So general anesthesia is when you're all the way asleep, but there's also kind of a spectrum there too. So we tell people we're gonna put you to sleep, but we can put you lightly to sleep We can put you medium to sleep, really asleep, or like dead out. So for certain procedures, we do kind of like a light sedation where you're really just sort of snoozing. And if I like tapped you on the shoulder or like yelled in your ear, you'd like wake up. And for other procedures, we don't want you to wake up under any circumstances. So we'll get you like deep and unarousable.
Hmm. When you say unarousable, is it you stop administering the medication and then the body just takes care of it, or you actually have to administer a different medication to arouse them?
Yes. So how to bring someone out of general anesthesia?
Yeah.
So we don't really have reversal agents for any of our main anesthetics. If someone discovers that, I would love them to come to me first and we'll go to the patent office together.
So you're saying there's money to be made.
There would be a lot of money to be made for that. So the way that people wake up from general anesthesia is we turn off the agent that's keeping you asleep and wait, basically. So if it's inhaled gas that we're using, then you're gonna, once we stop giving you that gas and just give you normal air, each breath you're gonna breathe out some of the gas that was in your bloodstream and lungs, and replace it with normal air and enough breaths, and it's gonna get down to a level where it's no longer keeping you asleep. If it's IV medication that we're using, then we're just waiting for that medication to either be metabolized so that it's no longer active, or to be redistributed into other tissues where it's not affecting the brain anymore.
Okay. So we need the layman working. I'm sure the layman are the people to solve this as well, of course. A reversal agent for general anesthesia. Let's get working on this, guys.
So what would be the advantages that you would have from having a reversal agent, just bringing people back more quickly, or?
So one of them would just be financial and logistical, is because sometimes, especially with a long surgery, if they've had that agent running for hours and hours, there's a lot of it built up in their system. And depending on their metabolism and things, and their like how much adipose tissue they have to like soak up the agent and things, sometimes it takes a long time to get rid of enough of it that they'll wake up. And so we sometimes have situations where the surgery's done and we're sitting around for 45 minutes, an hour, or an hour and a half in the operating room, and we can't take the tube out, we can't extubate them because they're like still completely like zonked. So that would save hospitals a lot of money, let them turn over faster, which is why it would be a very lucrative thing to have. From a patient safety perspective, sometimes we'll induce general anesthesia in a patient. We push all that IV medication, they get knocked out to the point that, you know, they're not breathing on their own anymore. And our plan A was, we're going to do that, we're going to get a breathing tube in and then connect them to the ventilator. Well, sometimes you can't get the breathing tube in for some reason. They have weird anatomy or other things that just make it difficult to intubate. And if you find yourself in that situation, you would really like to get them unanesthetized as quickly as possible so that they start breathing on their own again. But unfortunately, we don't have anything to reverse quickly.
Interesting. Okay. Okay. A couple. Sorry, Matt, you had another question?
I was just going to say, none of this should be taken as like a, I mean, you shouldn't be, don't fear your anesthesiologist. They're there to help you, and they're going to make your life way better.
Yeah. Consider the alternative of having surgery without anesthesia.
Or not having surgery at all.
Oh, right.
And there's dying. That
too. Yeah. Okay. Well, as long as we get that caveat, then we can ask the next question too, which is, I've always wondered, you put people, like you said, there's different levels of it, but let's say you put them like all the way out. It seems like incontinence has to be on the table. If you, I mean, that pun intended, fully. Is that ever happened?
You know, I was very fascinated by that question because I hadn't thought about it until you asked that. But then I was, when I thought about it, I'm like, you know, I very rarely see that happen. And I don't know why that is, because if you think about it, holding your stool in and not soiling yourself is something that you have to learn. It's not, you're not born like that.
Right.
So it's not a inherent reflex or instinct that we have. And yet all of these other reflexes, like blinking, gagging, coughing, swallowing, these like very basic, like built-in reflexes, when we induce general anesthesia, those are gone. So why is it that those are gone, but you're still like holding it in your stool? I don't know. It's very fascinating. But I would say it's, you know, only a few times a year that we have what the nurses like to call a code brown, when they go to take the patient off the bed and they're like, oh, they soiled themselves. We need a minute to clean this up.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So it does happen, but just very rarely.
It does happen, but it's not.
I'd kind of assumed that was one of the reasons why they tell you, like, don't eat for a while before you go into surgery.
No, that actually has to do with aspiration risk. So we want your stomach empty, because when we're putting the breathing tube in, occasionally people can vomit. And or when we're going off to sleep and before we get the tube in, you may vomit. And if you've got a cheeseburger in there and you vomit up a cheeseburger, but you don't have enough of the like protective reflexes to like protect your airway, that may go right down into your airway and cause some really bad problems.
Yeah. Okay.
But you want your stomach empty for that reason.
Learn something new every day. They're not kidding when they say don't eat.
Yeah. Yeah. I've fortunately never seen that, but I hear horror stories occasionally about people who have had someone vomit up food and it goes into their lungs and then they end up in the ICU and it's really terrible.
Wow. Okay. Well, that would
don't fear your anesthesiologist. Just listen and
you haven't eaten anything because.
Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. Better to postpone. Okay.
We'll tell you is that you have to wait an extra 4 hours or something for your surgery, or maybe even the next day or something like that.
Right. Right. Okay. I guess that leads me into my next question. How often do you have medical issues resulting from anesthesia? Like, you said you've never seen, you know, these horror stories, but do you see, like, is it pretty common for there to be issues relating to general anesthesia?
I would say issues with anesthesia are fairly common, but they're not the scary issues that people dread, or that we would like lose sleep over either. And anesthesiology has actually been one of the
seems like you have practice putting to sleep and putting to sleep. It seems like this one is the latter putting to sleep of the children. You're good.
Yeah, what was I saying?
The types of reactions people are having from general anesthesia are not generally bad?
They're not generally bad. The things that are the most common are having a sore throat from having a plastic tube sitting there. I'd say that occurs in most people, but it's generally mild and goes away within a day or so. Having some nausea and vomiting from breathing the gas particularly can occur in especially younger women, but it can happen in anybody. And that one is very obnoxious, but it's not, you know, particularly dangerous to feel nauseous or vomit. It's just annoying and unpleasant. Sometimes we cause like a little lip laceration or something if like we're trying to get the tube in and it's hard, but it's a minor scrape or cut and it'll heal. And then post-op retention of urine can sometimes happen related to anesthesia. So people may not be able to pee for a while and then they may have to get a catheter placed. Those, I think, are the most common things. Anesthesia used to be a field with high medical malpractice because more serious complications occurred more frequently. And then sometime in the last 20, 30 years, as a field, we really put a strong emphasis on systems-wide improvements for patient safety. And we adopted a lot of frameworks from the airline industry that we took and applied to medicine to make sure that patients weren't harmed by general anesthesia. So our rate of complications for serious things like went way down, and we almost never see like serious complications anymore.
That's good to know.
It's comforting.
Yeah, we can underline that for the layman out here that's worried about soiling themselves on the table.
Well, and you probably see fewer complications than the airline industry of late.
Yes, lately, that is true.
Yeah.
Sorry, we shouldn't reinforce fears.
So, young Dr. Vogel, or future Dr. Vogel, also have an insight here? no, okay, a couple more questions, Seth. I've always wondered, you hear about medically induced comas. Are those, is that a complete different medication, or is that just constant administration of one of these drugs you've already mentioned?
So medically induced comas are sort of a last resort thing. And we don't use them very often. I've never personally done one, but it's more of an ICU thing anyway, rather than, and I'm mostly in the operating rooms. So in answer to your question, you can use the same agents that you use for general anesthesia and just give them indefinitely or however long you need, you know?
Yeah.
But another way of inducing a general, like a medically induced coma, is just cooling a patient down. Sometimes after if someone's found down by paramedics and they've had a heart attack and they've been laying there for who knows how long, and they're not responsive or something, you may want to cool the patient's, like bring the patient's core body temperature down to protect their organs by decreasing the metabolic, it's like oxygen demand. So if you can basically slow everything down by cooling them, then it can protect their brain and other organs. And so that's another way of inducing a medical coma.
Okay. What about, I know that, I don't have direct, my wife had 5 kids. She decided against an epidural. I don't know why. That was her decision, and I have no say in that.
My wife was also opted against epidurals both times.
Okay. What? How difficult are epidurals? And is that something that you practice specifically, or is that, what is that process?
Epidurals. I was very scared of doing them when I first started because it seemed daunting. But after a week of being on my OB rotation, I felt very comfortable doing labor epidurals. That being said, you can put an epidural anywhere in the spine, pretty much. And for labor epidurals, for pregnant women, we go pretty low, below where the spinal cord terminates. So the risk of having a catastrophic like paraplegic situation, you know, from injuring someone's spinal cord is basically zero.
Okay.
A lot of people worry about it because they're like, well, the needle's going in right next to my spine, right? or it's going into my spine. And it is going near the spine, but not near the spinal cord. And so that's actually pretty safe, and it's not too difficult to do, but, you know, it sometimes is for certain patients if they've got scoliosis or they've had back surgery or, you know, really bad arthritis in their back that's makes the spine anatomy different, then it can sometimes be challenging to get it in. But for the most part, no. One of the scariest things that I do still is a thoracic epidural, which is higher up in the back, and is sometimes used for surgeries where they're going to make like a big incision for like a liver case or something like that. And for pain control, we can put in a thoracic epidural that will cover all of that pain when someone wakes up. Those ones, if you don't do it right, you could go into the spinal cord and cause some catastrophic injuries. So that always makes me a little bit nervous just because I'm like still training and I haven't done too many of them.
You mentioned that you do those with pretty close supervision while you're doing the training. I imagine you do all of this with pretty close supervision. They're not just like giving you needles and having you have at it.
No. And with the epidurals, they did a lot of like mannequin simulations and like different workshops and things before we ever touched a patient with an epidural needle. And then with the thoracic ones, yeah, they supervise you pretty closely. And thankfully, it's very rare to even have that complication, but that one is theoretically higher risk for having something really bad happen if someone was not careful and just jammed it right in there.
Do you get,
I was going to say, it's a good thing that your anesthesiologist gets a break or two during the day. So they're not in that kind of, you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
Do you get technology that helps you with any of these types of, you know, more difficult procedures when you're doing a thoracic epidural? Do you get eyes on it somehow? Do you get to see like, okay, like this is, or is it just like, let's hope this one works?
So the vast majority of epidurals these days are still done, we say blindly, but that just means that you're not seeing where the needle tip is. You're doing it by feel. And so you're pushing the needle in, you're feeling that you're in a certain ligament in between the spinal levels. And then you've got a little syringe that you're using to feel if there's resistance on that syringe when you inject some saline. And when you get into the epidural space, you're going to suddenly feel a loss of resistance on the syringe, and it tells you that you've advanced it into the right spot. But, you know, if you go off to one side or another, you may not get the right the exact sensation that you're expecting. So I don't know why we don't use ultrasound more often for these, because it does exist that you have these dedicated ultrasound machines that are for epidurals. I've only used it once or twice, and that was in a patient who had like a BMI of 60, and it was impossible for me to even feel where the spine was on their back. And so I was like, you know, I'm not going to poke this person 5 or 6 times without even knowing if I'm in the middle or if I'm in the right spinal level. So I got the ultrasound for that patient, and it worked beautifully. So I think in the future, maybe we'll use that more often.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, from once again, all of my experience is anecdotal because I'm not a doctor or a doctor. I'm a patient. And, but my wife had
a layman, as it were.
A layman. Exactly. My wife had an amniocentesis. Mm-hmm. At one point, and they had an ultrasound in on that so they could see where the needle was going, obviously not to poke the baby, just didn't know if that was ever the case for you, for anesthesiologists, or what that process was. But
yeah, we use ultrasound a lot for other things. I think one of the reasons why it's not like widespread for epidurals is that even the ultrasound that we have right now is mainly used for kind of like finding the entry point and sort of mapping out how deep your needle tip is expected to go. But it's hard to get like live visualization of the needle tip just because of the way that the spine is positioned. The bones cause like acoustic shadowing so that you can't see very well once your needle's going into the spine.
Okay, interesting. Okay, let's get a couple more in here. How loopy, or not how loopy, but why are people loopy when they're coming up? We're at the beginning. We talked about that guy that I knew that came out and was speaking his second language as if that was the only language he knew. Most people, you see the YouTube videos of so and so just being. I mean, it's essentially like they're drunk. Is that what it looks like in the brain? Is that what's happening?
I mean, that's a good analogy, and I think it's a pretty apt one. What's happening is different parts of the brain are waking up at different rates, and for some reason, the frontal cortex wakes up a little bit later. And that's the part that gives you sort of your inhibitions and social cues, you know?
Yeah.
So we have a lot of patients who wake up and start hitting on nurses or saying weird things, or they wake up and try and punch you in the face.
Watch out for those ones.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I've heard all these stories, and the first time I woke up from general anesthesia, I was pretty sure I needed to like get up and start helping the nurses and the doc. Like somehow I was employed there at that point. Like there was clearly they needed me to also be doing something. So, okay. But
well, that would be a pleasant type of loopy to have someone just trying to help instead of knock me out.
Yeah. I wasn't trying to punch anyone. Does that depend, the amount of loopiness, does that dependent on the drug? You said if you put people just barely under when they come to, you said they're more lucid?
Yeah. People do tend to get back to their baseline faster if you run a lighter anesthetic.
Okay. Why? I think you've essentially already addressed this, but laughing gas seemed like a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I've never had it. But is the reason that we moved?
It's pretty fun.
Is the reason that we, as if I were a doctor, that the medical community has moved away from laughing gas, is like you said, that people had reactions to it?
I think there's a couple reasons. One is that we have better gases to use. So it's impossible to get to like a surgical plane of anesthesia with just laughing gas. It's not a strong enough agent. So you can help sort of take the edge off. You can get maybe through like a really a not super painful procedure, but you're not going to be able to fully knock someone out with laughing gas. Okay. And so having the ability to like titrate something to a deeper level of anesthesia is nice. And that's why people sometimes just don't bother with the laughing gas. That being said, it has some advantageous properties, like it is really fast onset, fast to recover from. So sometimes people use it for that reason. It has a fair number of side effects. It really is nausea inducing in a lot of people. And something that gets talked about a lot, at least at my institution, and reason most people avoid it, is it's terrible for the environment. So,
oh, interesting.
Most of our gases are not great for the environment, but nitrous oxide or laughing gas is like particularly bad. So,
Interesting. Okay. Well, I'll get rid of my stash then real quick by burying it or something. Okay. Two more questions. Anesthesiologist sounds like a pretty good I wouldn't say cushy, Seth. I mean, you put a lot of work in here, but it sounds like a nice profession as far as doctors go. How long is your residency? Do you have like, I know the fellowships or whatever after residency, what is the process to become an anesthesiologist?
So in this country, you do 4 years or more of undergraduate, and then you go to medical school for 4 years, and then it's another 4 years of residency. There are fellowships in anesthesia and things like pain medicine, critical care, obstetrics, and, you know, regional blocks and things like that. Those are all 1 year fellowships. So 4, maximum 5 years of post medical school training to become a licensed, certified, bona fide anesthesiologist.
Nice. Okay.
For reference, is pretty average for residencies. There are some that are 3, not many. Most are 4. And then there are the really crazy ones like neurosurgery that are like 7 to 9 years of post-medical residency.
Oh, brutal.
You know what? I'm okay with that one taking longer. Just from a consumer perspective, not a provider perspective. But yeah, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I guess when we say brain surgeons, you have a relatively high bar for...
I mean, you could go to like Rob's Express House of Neurosurgery certification, and
so open you bet my doctor
back alley practice, but
yeah, I'll bet those probably... people doing lobotomies in the 1800s didn't go to school for 9 years.
Yeah,
they started with leeches and they moved on from there.
Yeah, I don't know how many insurance plans cover that kind of thing.
Okay. My last question, and maybe my best question. You kind of already teased an answer to this, though. So a number of years ago, I have a friend who works in the police force, and he talked about how to get a taser, to be issued a taser, you have to be tased. Mm-hmm. So you know it feels. So is that the case with anesthesiologists? Do you have to, you know, do they have to be able to put you under? You know, what are the, you know, what do you got to do? Does someone have to stick you with the needle and put you out before you get the final certificate?
I don't think you have to get an epidural before you're allowed to do an epidural.
You know, that's true. Matt is correct on that one. I kind of wish that they did have that requirement, because I had general anesthesia. And so I tell people, you know, what it's like based on what it's reported to be like from other patients.
Right.
And I think there is some value to experiencing things for yourself. So okay, I've seen a viral in the anesthesia world, so probably not viral in the sense that you would have seen it.
But I assume you guys have your own version of TikTok, right?
Yeah. So a viral video amongst anesthesiologists is this attending anesthesiologist who's teaching a fiber optic intubation technique where you intubate someone who's awake, and he teaches it on this like YouTube video by intubating himself live on camera.
Oh my.
Okay.
Wow.
So that turns some heads. I don't know that I would want to go that far, but
some of
my colleagues who I would trust to intubate me, and I think it would be a valuable experience.
Yeah. Yeah, probably not live
it's not quite the same thing. But at one point I went through a like first aid, like immediate trauma care course, and they taught some of the lessons that the US military had learned in Afghanistan. And one of the anecdotes was that some of the soldiers, when they would go out, they had a plastic tube called a nasal pharyngeal airway that, you know, you put that in place through the nose down into the mouth to kind of keep the airway clear in case anything, in the case of something bad happened. And they mentioned that some of the soldiers would like put that in place preemptively.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's pretty hard. So, and granted, that's not quite the same as intubation, but it seems like it's awfully similar.
It's not nearly as bad as intubation. Getting intubated is actually the most stimulating part of the surgery. It's worse than getting your like chest cracked open.
Stimulating it from a technical sense, in terms of like it's actually stimulating nerves and making you respond to.
Yes, stimulating yeah. the sense that like if we were doing it, if we were not anesthetizing you and we are doing surgery, and then we told you after we asked you afterwards, what was the worst part of surgery? You would probably say getting intubated was the worst part.
Oh my.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah.
So you would not want to do that without a lot of drugs on board, and we give people a lot of drugs before we go for that.
Again, we're talking drugs in the technical sense.
But the nasal thing that you're talking about, but myself, I don't think that that's that bad. And I know people who have put in like NG tubes in themselves, and like those are a little bit like unpleasant, but you know, we do it in people with like little or no sedation, and people do just fine with that.
Okay, maybe I'm just overly squeamish.
It's like Matt wouldn't like the when you suck the spaghetti up your nose and like cough it out your mouth and floss. All right. Okay. And on that note, we'll end this riveting podcast. This has been great. Thank you, Seth. I appreciate the insights. Matt, any final questions?
No, I think that you've covered everything, that you can learn in 4 years of post-medical school training, and you've covered it succinctly in about an hour. So
Matt does this at the end of every podcast, Seth.
That's because we're just that good. I'm ready to be a graphic designer, anesthesiologist, rocket scientist. Oh, wait, I didn't do the rocket science one yet. That's coming.
We'll have a rocket science podcast soon. No, that's been great. Seth, thank you for your knowledge, and we'll have to have you back on the podcast sometime in the future. You can discuss, you talked a lot about your doctor training, but we got to talk about your doctor training. So your research. Thank you. And join us for our next episode, and we'll see you then.
All right. Thanks, Carl. Thanks, Matt. It's fun.